for our last regular presentation of the day, we have Bruce Allardyce. Bruce Allardyce is local. Just makes him that much more knowledgeable. His presentation, as you can see behind me, is Chicago Hates Cincinnati, How Pro Baseball Conquered the Windy City. Please, Bruce.
Thank you. Thank you, Anthony. Today I hope to explore how professional baseball arrived in Chicago. In this presentation, I'll talk about the growth of baseball in this one commercial city, explore who played the game, and finally, reveal how Chicago's hatred of Cincinnati caused Chicago to adopt professional baseball. But first, a little quiz here. What do Ernie Banks, Angelina Jolie, Albert Einstein, and Harry Carey have in common? Anybody? None of them ever saw the Cubs win a World Series game. Well, the first baseball came to Chicago relatively early. The first Chicago baseball team, the Union Baseball Club, was in fact organized on August 12, 1856. And it is in all probability the first baseball club organized west of the Appalachian Mountains. Pictured here is the first known baseball game in Chicago, a match between the Chicago Union and a team made up from the suburb of Downers Grove, known as the Plowboys. There's the Plowboys logo there. And note that Chicago, in the first game it ever played, lost, setting a standard for future Chicago baseball teams. Now, in 1867, the Chicago Tribune portrayed the baseball players of Chicago as, quote, the choicest young businessmen, many of them a noble set of young men, vigorous, healthy, athletic, fitted for honorable contentions, the best blood of their respective communities. It's easy to see why Chicago's business community promoted the game. In fact, a look at the first Chicago noted team, the Chicago Excelsiors, confirms that the teams were made up of young clerks of the great merchant houses, the sons of Chicago's elite. There's been a study by a gentleman named Friedman who estimates that 70% of early Chicago ballplayers were middle or upper class. Now, the Excelsiors, and pictured is Dr. William Hunt, the first president of this Excelsiors amateur team. The Excelsiors were, in a way, the predecessors of today's Chicago Cubs. And you'll note, again, from the Tribune clipping here, that the future Chicago Cubs lose their first city championship game, again establishing a Cubs tradition that lasts to this day. But by the late 1860s, amateur teams like the Excelsiors had, of course, realized that they couldn't compete with teams that hired professionals. So these Excelsiors actually hired their own professionals. And of course, they didn't hire the right professionals or something. They kept on losing it, and the Chicago Excelsiors team disbands in 1868. Now, these two charts show interest in baseball, both nationwide and in Chicago. I wanted to statistically prove or show how baseball interest was increasing in the nation. So I did a statistical study of just the mentions of the name of the word baseball in newspaper databases. The one is four nationwide databases, and the second is the Chicago Tribune. And as you can see, before the war, a little growth slows down during the war. After the war, explosive growth, with a little delay, a little pause in 1868 for reasons I can't figure out. But Chicago baseball interest is paralleling the interest nationwide. Now, pictured here is the Cincinnati Red Sox of 1869, the first openly professional team. Now, when I say openly professional, I refer to the fact that many of the amateur teams of the late 1860s had in fact hired players away from other teams, promising jobs, promising other inducements. If you're familiar with the Ohio State football program, you will understand how amateur teams can pay off supposedly amateur players. Well, this is nothing new. The amateur teams of baseball did exactly this in the 1860s. And the Red Stockings quickly proved that if your team wants to compete at the highest level, part-time amateur players simply can't match up with these full-time professional teams. The Reds, as you know, set a record of 81 straight wins, touring the nation, and defeating the local amateur teams by lopsided margins. Why did Chicago hate Cincinnati? Right there, pork. Both cities vied in the 1860s for the title of Porkopolis, the pork-producing capital of America. God knows why. By the 1860s, in fact, the Chicago stockyards were slaughtering so many pigs that, if laid end to end, the pigs would stretch from Chicago to Florida. Chicago became jealous of Cincinnati's baseball success. As one Chicago magazine put it, the financial and playing success of the Cincinnati club was too much for Chicago to bear. She could not bear to see her commercial rival on the Ohio bearing off the honors of the national game, especially when there was money to be made by beating her. And many prominent Chicagoans decided to do something about it. Chicago's business elite decided to organize their own professional team to compete and beat the Reds. Now, pictured here is Potter Palmer, perhaps Chicago's wealthiest person at the time, probably its most prominent merchant. He was the original owner of what later became Marshall Field's department store. At this time, he's busy planning and building the very hotel we are in today, the Palmer House. He was a baseball fanatic, and in October of 1869, he accepted the head of the Chicago Baseball Club. It was founded to bring professional baseball to the Windy City. The board members of this club read like the social register of the city of Chicago at the time. Board members include George Pullman, the Pullman Car Company, General Phil Sheridan, Civil War hero, Joseph Medill, later the editor of the Chicago Tribune. And their creation was the Chicago White Stockings, the direct ancestor of the Chicago Cubs. What was the object of the new club? In the words of manager Jimmy Wood, quote, beat the Red Stockings in 1870 and damn the expense. Now here's pictures of some of the early board members. General Sheridan, if you've ever heard of Fort Sheridan, you know he's named after him. He's soon to become General in Chief of the Army. Brother of Senator Farwell from Illinois. And of course, George Pullman, the civil engineer who was the Pullman car inventor and popularizer. Many of the membership team of the old amateur Chicago Excelsiors joined this new professional club, including former Excelsiors, President Willard F. Wentworth, as vice president of this organization, and Secretary William Lowe. The president of this new organization was respected hotel owner and future city treasurer, David Gage. The Chicago Club was organized January 17, 1870, as a joint stock company. And as one magazine put it, in Chicago, the first thing to do toward any achievement is to form a stock company. In Chicago, nobody builds a church or pickles a winter stock of cucumbers without first forming a joint stock company. Shares of stock were sold at $25 a piece and honorary memberships at $100 a piece, raising more than $15,000. This was the first baseball club organized as a joint stock company, raising capital through the sale of stock. It supplanted the previous club business models of raising funds via member dues, fees, and subscriptions. And this joint stock company model was the business model for all future professional baseball teams. Pictured there, of course, is President Gage. He becomes Chicago City Treasurer, and again, in a final Chicago tradition, when he leaves the treasurership in 1875, it's found that $500,000 of city funds was missing. Oh, Chicago solicits paper. This is a copy of an ad that was run in the New York Clipper by Torres C. Cowles, secretary of the organization. Manager James Leon Jimmy Wood was soon deluged with responses from the top players of Eastern clubs. One of the difficulties about this Chicago club in its early formation was the club management was getting so many responses to this, they sort of dithered as to who they wanted to hire. Here's a photo of the Chicago White Stockings in 1870, posing in front of their Dexter Park home. Now, you may not recognize the names of all these players, but the fans at the time knew that these were top players drawn from the best clubs in the East. As the Chicago Tribune wrote, quote, "We want nothing in this city but a first-class organization composed of players whose superiority there is no room for argument." The so-called $18,000 nines payroll dwarfed the payroll of the 1869 Red Stockings. So Chicago's fans were confident that they had assembled a first-class club. However, the local newspapers declined to predict whether they could beat the Red Stockings, quote, "the invincible, invariable conquerors of last season. Everyone must wait and see." Chicago's project was, quote, "received with nothing but derision," unquote, elsewhere, claimed the New York newspapers. Eastern writers jeered at the notion of a team so organized and directed as the Chicago Club, derided as wholly as what is it, could prove successful. They also alleged that manager Wood obtained some of the players by getting them drunk, and while they were pleasantly fuddled, luring them to Chicago with tons of cash. Now, the Chicago Club did sort of a spring training that season. They went south and they beat up on the local amateur teams, gaining a lot of confidence. In New Orleans, for example, they played a double team of locals, 18 against 9, and still won. In another game, they gave a rival team 6 outs instead of 3, and won again. Now, during this trip, a street urchin yelled at the white hosed Chicago team, quote, "Oh, look at the White Stockings." Club Secretary Torres Cowles, who was also a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, adapted the naming for an article he wrote on the team the next day, and the new nickname stuck. Now, perhaps the worst of the early games, or perhaps the best, depending on your point of view, was the White Stockings defeated the champion amateur club of Tennessee, the Bluff City of Memphis, 157-1. Chicago hit 8 home runs that day, 4 by Fred Tracy, with 119 singles and 181 total bases. Sounds like today's White Sox could use a little of that offense. Pouring it on, the White Stockings scored 23 runs in the ninth inning after they were leading 134-1. That spring, Chicago outscored its opponents 10-1, 483 runs to 48. However, when the White Stockings started to play professional teams, they often lost, disappointing their many Chicago boosters. The Eastern Press labeled them as the $18,000 Lemons. In early August, they lost to the Haymakers of Troy, New York, and the Tribune complained that, quote, "Since the organization of the White Stockings, they have not won a game against a first-class team." Also by mid-August, the team was $3,000 in debt. Perhaps the low point was the July 23rd game against the Mutual of New York, a 9-0 loss. In this high-scoring era, Chicago scoring zero runs was so extraordinary that baseball didn't even have a word like shutout to describe it. For years after, when a team scored zero runs, it was said to be Chicago'd. Several reasons for the poor play were suggested. First, player misconduct. The Tribune labeled the White Stockings, quote, champion loafers, careless, shiftless, whiny schoolboys, a mob amenable to no discipline and subject to no rules. This criticism especially stung since two members of the White Stockings boards were also members of the Chicago Tribune board. Two, lack of teamwork. Of course, they've gotten players smaller. It took them half a year to start playing together as a team. Three, the injury bug. It got so bad that manager Wood brought in Chicago amateurs to replace his injured professionals. When this hybrid team lost again, he canceled games against pro teams for 2 weeks in order to get everybody healthy again. Also, at the suggestion of baseball pioneer Henry Chadwick, the team switched to playing with a deader baseball, which caused fewer broken fingers. Four, weak pitching. They finally settled on Ed Pinkman's pitcher. That and improved defense, they started to get better. And fifth, change in management. In early August 1870, the stockholders elected Colonel Norman Gassett, a respected veteran and city clerk, president. The management change seemed to shake up and revitalize the team. After the management change, the team went 25-1 the rest of the year. But of course, since in the Cincinnati games are the big ones. On September 7th, the new and improved White Stockings played Cincinnati at the latter's home field. The local Cincinnati bettors offered 20-1 odds that their team would win. But they found few takers outside the small band of Chicagoans who'd made the road trip. However, in a huge upset, the White Stockings won that game 10-6. The Cincinnati newspapers and the Eastern Press as a whole poo-pooed the upset, accusing the umpire, agreed to by both teams, by the way, of being both ignorant of the rules and biased toward Chicago. The rematch of the best 2 out of 3 series was played in Chicago, October 13th. This time, the betting odds were even. Dexter Park Racetrack, which the White Stockings used for its bigger games, was swamped by tens of thousands of spectators. The crowd estimates ranged from 18,000 to 52,000. But a high total, arguably the biggest crowd ever see a baseball game at that time. The crowd was so big they broke through the fences lining the stadium. They entered the field and of course they didn't pay admissions. The game was just as exciting. Trailing 11-7 in the ninth inning, Chicago rallied with 9 runs in the top of the ninth inning to win a thrilling 16-13 victory. And the perspectives of the rival city's newspapers on this game says it all. The Chicago Tribune's headline and subheadline great gave credit to the power of money. White above red. The redoubtable White Stockings defeated by Chicago's $18,000 nine. When the Garden City, we weren't the witty city yet, the Garden City sets out to do a thing, she does it. It took money to accomplish the business, but it is done. Cincinnati's reaction from the Cincinnati Gazette was more personal. Quote, the umpire was against us. The weather was against us. The crowd was against us. The heavens were against us. The ground was against us. The pestilential air of the Chicago River was against us. The Chicago Nine were against us. And last but not least, the score was against us. And as a postscript to this game, in keeping with the great Chicago tradition of honesty, the White Stockings promptly cheated the Red Stockings out of their share of the admissions. They finished out the season. This is the 1870 record of the top teams. In those days, the general agreement was that the team that won the most games should be able to claim the championship. And the New York Mutual, even though they had a lesser winning percentage than the White Stockings, claimed it on the basis of those 29 wins. The White Stockings, on the other hand, claimed it by winning head-to-head matches late in the year against the Mutual and, of course, against the Cincinnati Red Stockings. One of those head-to-head matches, by the way, against the Mutual was a very disputed game. The Mutual walked off the field in protest of the umpire being biased toward the White Stockings. The White Stockings, by the way, were 43-1 against amateur teams that year. Well, what happened the next year? The White Stockings actually had a very good team the next year. They were tied with first going into the late part of the season. And then, yes, the Great Chicago Fire, October 8, 1871. A lot of tragedies in this fire, perhaps for our purposes. The biggest one is that the team's stadium, a new stadium near the lakefront, burned. The team records burned. The team bats burned. The team uniforms burned. A lot of their cash savings burned. The team was orphaned. The club collapsed. And pro baseball did not return to Chicago until 1874. For 2 years, Chicago was too busy rebuilding the town to bother to try and revive professional baseball in Chicago. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Questions? The Dexter Park grounds, in 1870, the White Stockings played at two different places, really. If it was an amateur game where they thought it was going to be a low turnout, it was at Ogden Park, which is about a mile and a half north of here on the corner of Ontario and Michigan Avenue. Dexter Park was a racetrack at 42nd and Halstead Streets, adjacent to the Chicago Stockyards. For the bigger games, they went down there and basically erected a ball field on the infield of the racing track. But this was an enclosed thing already. It wasn't an ideal location, but for a big crowd, that was the best thing that they could handle.
What was the amateur team that actually beat the White Stockings?
I have that documentation, I think. See me after this talk, and I'll be happy to give that to you. I have the whole 1870 record. But that's just, they losing the amateur teams. Obviously, they weren't doing too well at that point. Other questions, comments?
Okay, thank you very much.